Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily political podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast and I'm today joined by James Forsyth and Katie Balls. So James, the weekend papers were full of discussions about a second referendum and these tales of Tory MPs plotting for a second referendum. I mean, do you think at this stage we actually are looking at the possibility of a second referendum?
I think a second referendum is not an unlikely outcome at this point. As I wrote on Saturday, so the cabinet ministers who want one want these indicative votes in the House of Commons because they think that Theresa May is so set against a second referendum, she'll never propose one herself. What they're hoping is that a second referendum will emerge as a popular among MPs option if you gave MPs a series of free votes in the Commons. And then there would be space for Theresa May to say, well, I'm not doing it, Parliament is saying it wants it to happen. And then they also think that one of the other ways they think they could get her to a referendum is to say, well, why don't we do it on your deal versus no deal? So no one's disrespecting the result of a 2016 referendum. But they would know that in that circumstance, once you got the idea onto the dance floor, Parliament would insist that Remain was an option on the ballot paper. So I mean, that these are the kind of two ways they're looking at getting to a second referendum. But I mean, I think there are definitely a good number of cabinet ministers who are quite keen on the idea. There are people in Downing Street who are keen on the idea. But Theresa May is very much against it. And I think one of the things that makes it so hard to see where things go from here is that Theresa May is personally fervently against most of the other options, right? So she's never going to, she would absolutely loathe to do Norway because that involves continuing free movement, which is what she thinks the referendum result was all about. So by her own definition of what that result was about, you would be disrespecting the result to do that. And yet she's also set herself completely and utterly against the second referendum, which brings you back to her deal. And you know, there is, in this great game of chicken she is playing with Parliament to try and pass her deal, I don't see any sign that the MPs are getting out of her way. I think the opposition to her deal remains far too strong for her to bring the thing to the House of Commons chamber for a vote. And that is why we are so stuck at the moment.
And Katie, how would these indicative votes work?
So it's not entirely clear, as with quite a lot of things on Brexit. There is an argument going forward that these votes should happen after Theresa May has asked MPs to vote on her deal. There are some people who think it could happen before or around the same time. They would be votes, basically, where MPs would be asked to say which of the scenarios they support. So you would have a vote on the Norway option, having an EEA-type relationship with the EU, which would mean you still had freedom of movement. You have a vote on Theresa May's deal. You would have a vote on the idea of a second referendum, perhaps even a vote on no deal. And that way you would work out where the numbers were for each option. I think there are, as James says, some people who think this is a good way to show that there is support for a second referendum and get the idea out there. I think there are other people who think it might actually help Theresa May because it shows there is a majority for nothing, which you could use to argue for a second referendum, where you could use to say, hey, right now you're all being incredibly optimistic that if you vote down Theresa May's deal, you're going to get your way. Look here, you're not. Like, everyone is divided here. So it might help make people think about things in a new light. Again, that itself, though, is quite optimistic. So I think we're still at the point where we're trying to work out some way to break this Brexit impasse. And I don't think we've got there yet.
And James, for the cabinet ministers who do want a second referendum, I mean, do you get a sense of what kind of questions they'd want to see on the ballot paper?
All of the cabinet ministers who I can think of who want a second referendum want it because they would ultimately like the UK to remain in the EU. One of those who wants it was saying to me last week that they would hope that collective responsibility would be lifted for the referendum so that they could even campaign to stay in. Now, I can understand that why those ministers feel that they haven't changed their minds since 2016. Do they worry about what voters would think? Because you've been in a government that was charged with delivering this, and now you're saying, well, actually, I still want to stay. I mean, that would be problematic in terms of how the public would see things, without a doubt. I don't think they actually want deal versus no deal on the ballot paper, but they might initially suggest that to Theresa May because, you know, once you get there, this legislation would have to go through the House of Commons. And in that scenario, Parliament would amend it. Also, you would need an extension to Article 50 to hold this referendum. And I would be slightly surprised if the EU said, you can have an extension to Article 50 to hold a referendum on deal versus no deal, because, you know, they would not regard no deal as a good outcome for them. And so I think they would be sceptical about giving the UK more time, which would obviously be time that could be spent getting ready for that scenario, to hold a referendum in those circumstances.
And I mean, are there any Brexiteers who would like to see a second referendum in the hope that the country might then vote more definitively for Brexit?
I mean, you should ask Katie that question. She wrote a very interesting iColumn recently about the Brexiteers who do want a second referendum.
Katie?
I don't think it's the bulk view of all Brexiteers, but I would say there are a number of people who are, you know, Leave MPs, people who were involved with the Leave campaign, who are beginning to wonder if the options really are Theresa May's deal, which many see as worse than EU membership because you have less say in the rules, but you are still closely attached to Brussels, or an even softer Brexit in the form of Norway, or, you know, remaining. I think there is a growing thing that maybe, and if no deal is going to be stopped by the House of Commons, perhaps the only way you get back to that cleaner Brexit is by going out, having a second referendum and winning it. And that point being like, well, you tried to stop it already. Now we really do have the green light to go ahead. And I don't think it's such a crazy idea because we had Dom Cummings in charge of, you know, the Vote Leave campaign and the referendum. I think around summer, he wrote a blog where he said that if you do bring about a second referendum, don't be surprised when Vote Leave reform, Vote Leave 2, and they win by a larger margin. And he made the warning that if that were to happen, this time around they would not trust the establishment, the current politicians, to take control of it. There was a suggestion that perhaps you would have a new political party, you know, a Leave party. And all these things are, again, if, so we're back into the land of hypothetical. But I think it does show that if you start to get to a point of a second referendum, the Remain campaign would have an uphill battle trying to win it. It's definitely not a slam dunk. And I think there's lots of people on the Leave side who think that they could make gains or, you know, win again by pointing out the fact that people were ignored.
I think Katie is right in that it's obvious how the Leave campaign would run it. I mean, Katie wrote about how their slogan was going to be "Tell them again." And basically turning around to the public and say, "Tell them again, tell them loud if it didn't listen," obviously has an emotional, visceral appeal. I think one of the wrinkles to this, though, is that you talk to people on the Leave side who are quite up for a second referendum, but they are determined to make the other side, the Remainers in inverted commas, own it. They are determined that the people who, they do not want to give any cover to this. They want the people who tell the public you've got to go and vote again to be the other side, because that adds to the emotional force of their campaign, which is, you know, they didn't listen to you, you've got to go and do it all over again. Tell them again, tell them louder.
Yeah, and that "tell them again" slogan is from polling one Leave group, basically has got commissioned in preparation in case there is another referendum. And it does, again, show you that they are going to fight it and they are making preparations.
And just on that, if that does happen, do you think we'd see a revival of UKIP again, or has UKIP sort of gone off in quite a weird direction at this stage?
I think kind of UKIP is a kind of ex-party in a way, because it's been taken over by Gerald Batten, who's obviously he's more interested in kind of palling around with Tommy Robinson than he is in kind of classic Euroscepticism. But I expect that if there is another referendum, there will be a Nigel Farage vehicle. You know, I mean, this is a guy who is not shy of the limelight, and I think he will find a way to push himself forward. I'm sure they will create some kind of new organisational structure to fit around that.
That brings us on to Sajid Javid, who said that he wants EU immigration slashed by 80% under Brexit border reforms. Katie, what did you make of that?
Yes, this is his target when it comes to EU immigration, that he wants to reduce by 80%. It sounds like he's talking tough. And I think, again, what Theresa May is trying to do when she's trying to push her deal through is really push the immigration line. And part of the thinking around that was that they would be able to unveil ideas for this post-Brexit immigration system, which would, they thought, would help get it over the line by getting MPs to kind of see the things that they can take back control of, namely the border, perhaps not so much else. So I think this does feed into that, but perhaps predictably it has also upset probably as many people as it has pleased, because Quivel Queen quick to suggest that this is, you know, wouldn't necessarily be good for the economy because you actually need immigrants. And on top of that, the idea that it sends out this idea that Brexit is a small, you know, inward-looking Brexit rather than outward-looking. I think you need to see the plans, a more precise deal to work out either way, but again, I don't think it's the slam dunk, we'll get this deal through pledge that Theresa May needs.
I think if you look at Sajid Javid's interview in the Christmas issue, I think he is interesting on immigration, and I don't think he is the person pushing this 80% cut line. I mean, I think this is more a what Downing Street would like to happen than what he would like to happen. So his thing is, you know, yes, there has, that free movement has caused problems. He basically says that kind of regular supply of, I mean, having such easy access to such a large pool of labour has meant that business haven't invested enough in automation. And that's one of the reasons why UK productivity lags. And also having access to such a large pool of labour, you know, you increase the supply of labour by such a large amount, you are going to have some effect on wages, particularly at the bottom. But I think what he is more interested in is this idea of basically completely uncapping immigration at the high skilled end of things, which again doesn't sit entirely naturally with Theresa May, who is very much keen on this target of, you know, reducing immigration to the tens of thousands. Now, I've always thought one of the problems with free movement, which is kind of one of his knock-on effects, because politicians couldn't control immigration from the European Union, they began to tighten up in all other areas to a completely absurd extent and ended up kind of blocking the kind of immigration that absolutely bothers nobody. I mean, one of the things that Sajid Javid has done is to take NHS workers out of the immigration target, because you were getting to a ridiculous system when the NHS, which is a state-run system after all, was offering people jobs on 50,000 a year and then couldn't get them a visa because of a system kicking in. So I mean, I think this is the challenge. And I think the challenge about a post-Brexit immigration policy is to wean British business off its reliance on this very large labour pool without too much economic disruption, while at the same time bringing in more high-skilled migration, which is good for the economy. And frankly, I don't think it bothers any voters at all. I really don't think that Leave voters, wherever they were in the country, were particularly worried about the idea of Indian surgeons arriving to work in the NHS or American bankers arriving in buying a large house in Notting Hill.
British bankers might be a bit worried about that.
I think there is an issue, which is that, you know, I think the high-skilled immigration does sometimes draw the ire of journalists priced out of various parts of London. But it's obviously a kind of collective good.
And Katie, just finally, what do you make of these plans to refuse those who get 3 D's at A level a student loan?
I think it's interesting. It's part of this tuition fees and university review that's currently going on underway, and they're all just suggestions, they're not definite. One of the other things we're expecting that review to come out with is the Ed Miliband version of student loans, so reducing them from around £9,000 a year to around £6,000. I'm sceptical of that one because I think ultimately it'd be better to do something like rebrand them as a graduate tax, explain how tuition fees really work because we don't pay the full amount. But I think on this one specifically, which is the idea that if you get below 3 D's or 3 D's, then you're not going to get the support to go to university. I can see why some people might think this is, you know, unfair, elitist, but I think you have to look at the courses and what jobs they're going to get you. And you do have a problem at the moment where lots of universities offer courses which have very low rates of actually getting you into jobs, and they charge you the full £9,000 each a year, but I don't think you're necessarily going to get that much return on your degree. So to have that, basically some way of cracking down on that is probably a good thing. But one thing it does suggest is that if you get below those grades, they will suggest you do a more vocational course. But I always think there's this funny thing where we always talk about apprenticeships and how we want to like put more money into that and show that these are like the great things to do. But there always does seem to be the feeling that people want other people's children to do that. You know, or you want this sounds great for you. And I do think the idea that you're going to push people towards those kind of things that they get what people think is not very academic grades does again reinforce the idea that it's a second rate choice rather than, you know, something that should be equal to university.
I mean, UCAS published the details on people who are actually kind of worse off for going to university, the courses where people earn less than if they hadn't gone. I mean, there is a simple practical point, which is we should be a nation of a second chance, right? If people don't realise how serious their A levels are and they muck them up, they should be given the opportunity to go back, do them again, go to university when they're a mature student, when they're a bit more grown up, a bit more able to realise the importance of what they're doing. I mean, I think one of the things that I would hope that the government would not forget about in doing this review is it's really important to create a pathway for people who are 22 or 24 to go to university, as well as people who are 18. But I think just on a purely practical level, if you get 3 D's, right, and unless you basically show that your attitude has changed, you're not going to get that much out of a university degree. And there is also just a kind of simple fact, which is at some point you're trying to advance onwards, right, and you've got to have got to an appropriate level previously before you can do that. You're not going to get much out of a maths degree if you've got a D in maths A level, are you?
Thank you, James and Katie. And just a reminder that we've got a special Christmas subscription offer. You can get a year's subscription to The Spectator for just £99. And with that is either a bottle of Paul Roger champagne worth £60 or an Aspinall wallet. To get this offer, just go to spectator.co.uk/Christmas. Thanks for listening and do join us again tomorrow.